Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education, presenting Secrets from the White House.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How did Coco Chanel manage to live through the German occupation of France in comfort when so many of her countrymen suffered hunger, poverty, and depression? The legendary designer's anti-Semitic sentiments and her longtime affair with a German official in Vichy, France, have been well documented in the past. But my guest today has uncovered evidence that Chanel's involvement with Baron Hans Gunther von Dinklage extended beyond romance and into collaboration on Nazi spy missions. Hal Vaughn is a journalist and documentary film producer. His book, Sleeping with the Enemy, Coco Chanel's Secret War, is now available in paperback. Hal, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris, and I'm delighted to be with your listeners at KERA in Dallas, Texas. I'd like to relate to you a little anecdote about Chanel and Dallas, but before that, I want to tell you how I began this book.
Wonderful.
I actually was doing research to write a what would have been a trilogy about the life of a man by the name of H. Gregory Thomas. Now, Thomas was one of the first American spies. He worked for the OSS, the Office of Strategic Services, in both Madrid and in Portugal. And my idea was to wrap up my two earlier books about World War II and espionage and to write this story about Gregory Thomas, who was an incredible man. He was over 6 feet 5 inches tall, and was an enormous personality. I began research into Thomas's life, and I all of a sudden found out that he had something to do with Gabrielle Coco Chanel. In fact, he had been sent to Paris in 1940, before America entered the war, by the Wertheimer brothers, a family of Jewish faith, who owned the complete concession for Chanel's perfume and cosmetic products. His mission in Paris was to obtain the complete complicated formula for making Chanel No. 5 perfume in the Wertheimer factory in New Jersey, and to purchase and ship to the United States the essential essence that were necessary to make that perfume in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
As I went through the material on Gregory Thomas, I suddenly discovered in the police archives of Paris an extraordinary document which told about Chanel's, not only her collaboration, but the fact that she was recruited by the German military intelligence service, the Abwehr, into their special group in France, who were cooperating with the Germans and collaborating. Now, how does this tie into Dallas? At the end of Chanel's life, she was invited to Dallas by Stanley Marcus.
Sure.
To receive the famous Neiman Marcus Reward for extraordinary gifts to fashion. And in fact, she was accompanied, this is a rather strange event, she was accompanied on that trip with no less than the personage I was talking about, H. Gregory Thomas.
Hmm.
In any case, Chanel had never been to Texas, and she asked Stanley Marcus if she couldn't visit a Texas ranch. After visiting his store, which apparently specialized in quite extraordinary items like bathtubs for couples or planes for couples, she went on down to his Texas ranch, which was called Black Mark Farm, and there she had a ranch-style dinner and watched a bronco riding and roping show. Chanel was a terrible snob, and in fact, she didn't like the Western food. And so what did she do? Typical of Coco Chanel, she dumped her plate of barbecue meat and beans under the table and right onto the elegant satin slippers of another guest, no less than Elizabeth Arden.
Hmm.
And so goes Coco Chanel's visit to Dallas, Texas.
You know, you mentioned that she was a terrible snob. We associate her name today with this great wealth, with impeccable taste. It seems unlikely that anyone would have imagined that at the time of her birth in 1883. Can you talk about her family and her childhood?
Yes, very good. She had a terrible childhood. Her father was an alcoholic, a man who went from market to market selling his little goods that he purchased around the towns of southern France. And her mother suffered terribly from tuberculosis and, in fact, died. In fact, her mother died in Chanel's arms. The father then took Chanel and her sister and two brothers and put the whole little family, the girls only, into a convent and sent the brothers off to work on a farm. So Chanel spent the formative years of her life, I'm talking now about 12 years until she was almost 19, in a Catholic convent, or in a series of Catholic convents, where, in fact, she developed she was taught anti-Semitism.
Vehement anti-Semitism.
Well, remember, we're now talking about just before the turn of the century. Gabrielle Chanel was born in 1883. So she's 17 at the turn of the century. Mm-hmm. Now, the Catholic Church at those times taught that the people who killed Jesus were Jews. And whence come the anti-Semitism that was flagrant in France for many years? I'm sure many of your listeners will remember the famous Dreyfus affair, mm-hmm. the Jewish officer who was accused of spying for the Germans and sent off to a prison camp in Guyana. Where finally he was liberated and freed and returned to duty as a major in the French army, it having been found out that the whole thing was trumped up simply because he was a Jew. And so there we have it. And for years after that, throughout all of Europe, there was a rampant anti-Semitism, and Chanel was part of it.
But, you know, it's funny, you told that story earlier, Hal, about Stanley Marcus. Everyone knew that Stanley Marcus was Jewish, and she had, you know, you mentioned the Wertheimers. She had business relationships with Jewish people, and she would sell to them. She just didn't choose to associate with them. Is that accurate?
Well, you know, Chanel was Coco Chanel. When it suited her, people turned out not to be Jewish. I mean, the Rothschilds were very close friends of Gabrielle Chanel.
Mm-hmm.
And she had all kinds of relationships with people of Jewish faith, if it happened to suit her. Now, the other part of her, this part that was developed in these institutions that she was brought up in, and let's understand that these are not boarding schools. These
right.
were very, very tough, difficult places where I'm sure Gabrielle Chanel scrubbed the floors. It was part of her life. It was just part of her. There is no explanation for this. People are just brought up like this, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. So talk about how Gabrielle Chanel became Coco Chanel.
Yes. Well, all of this takes place in a period which is just prior to the First World War. She leaves the convent, and for a short period of time, she works in cafes, singing. Gabrielle Chanel thought she had a voice, and she thought she could sing, and indeed she sang. And she sang a song about a rooster, which was called Coco. And the audience began to call her Coco. Hmm. Whence came her name Coco Chanel, which lasted for the rest of her life. From there, Chanel she either fell in love with or was seduced by a French army officer, and she went to live with the man whose name was Etienne Balsan at his estate. for a period of 3 years.
And Balsan ultimately would make investments not only in Chanel's social education, but in her professional investment.
Exactly. Balsan was an incredibly wealthy man and a very generous man. He was desperately in love with Chanel. And he, first of all, he taught her, how shall I say, the way to live in society,
mm-hmm.
at least to live in the society of that period. Chanel, by at the time she met Balsan, Chanel was quite crude. She didn't have good manners. She didn't know which knife to use or which fork to use, and there were many in those days. And so Balsan taught her all of this. And it's through Balsan that she meets her first, according to her great love, a fellow by the name of Boy Capel, who, with Balsan, invested in her first atelier, which was a hat-making business in Paris. They then financed her boutique, or they financed a boutique, which became her boutique and La Maison Chanel, at 29 Rue Cambon, where it is still today. If you go outside of the Hotel Ritz by the back door, you're on the Rue Cambon, and if you look across the street, you see a whole series of boutiques and workshops that Chanel put up, and which exists still today, where people go and buy perfume, and they go in and be fitted for clothes, and so forth and so on.
And, you know, today we think of it as a sort of a common thing for designers to launch a perfume line, and they have shoes and handbags and hats and clothing and everything else. But this was something unusual in Chanel's time.
Well, it was certainly unusual for the moment. Chanel wasn't the first person, fashion person to associate perfume with her clothes. But indeed, she had a great sense of what was needed to please women, and she had a great sense of how to put it all together and make it work. And she used not only her own skills, but the skills of professionals to create a whole series of perfumes. And the one she really liked the best, she named it Chanel No. 5.
Hmm.
Now, she didn't have the capacity financially, or in fact the time, and she wanted to devote her major work to the fashion business, making dresses and suits and what have you. So by accident, she met the Wertheimer brothers at the race course just outside of Paris. It's in the Parc de Boulogne. The Wertheimers had their own perfume business. So Chanel approached them and said, or it was proposed perhaps by somebody else, that the Wertheimers might want to become involved in financing her new perfume business. And indeed they did. They not only financed it, they took 90% control of it, had the capital, I'm talking now about in those days, tens of millions of dollars, to be able to bring the perfume to the world market. So there went Chanel in her first perfume venture.
Journalist and documentary film producer Hal Vaughn is with us. We're talking about his book, Sleeping with the Enemy, Coco Chanel's Secret War, which is now available in paperback. We'll come back to the conversation in a moment. If you'd like to join us, the telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, presenting Secrets from the White House Kitchen, lecture, book signing, and hors d'oeuvres, October 16th with Chef John Hanney III. More at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist and documentary film producer Hal Vaughn. His book, Sleeping with the Enemy, Coco Chanel's Secret War, is available now in paperback. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. So, Hal, throughout the First World War, throughout the 1920s, Coco Chanel continues, as we say today, building her brand. And it does seem like the 20s were an ideal time for someone with very innovative ideas to reach this market of women who had begun to think of their lives in really different terms.
Yes, indeed it did. This is Chanel's glorious moment. After the First World War, and even during the First World War, Chanel was already employing 300 people to make dresses and suits and so forth. And it's in 1917, people will perhaps be amazed by this, the fact that she personally launches, short hair. Following which, she opens her Rue Cambon boutique, financed by her lover, and begins to become a star, if you want, of fashion. It's also at this moment that she loses her lover. Boy Capel dies. He's killed in an automobile accident, and Chanel goes off to Venice to mourn him. And the mourning lasts for almost a year. It's a period when Chanel is almost void of creativity. And then she has another shock. Her younger sister, Antoinette, commits suicide. And I want to recall to you the fact that her older sister, Julia Berthe, also committed suicide. This is just an insight in the kind of background and education these women had after the death of the mother with tuberculosis. Chanel's best friend, Paul Morand, has, I think, something quite important to say about her suffering. He says that her suffering led her to be abusive, to be sarcastic, destructive, full of anger. And according to Morand, she was la belle dame sans merci. And also, she was the exterminating angel of the fashion world in the 20th century. Quite an insight into the Chanel that we know so, the intimate Chanel that we know so little about.
She did take a really solicitous role in caring, or at least providing for her nephew, who was left orphaned when his mother died.
Indeed. His name was André Palas. There were some authors who pretended that André Palas was, in fact, her Gabriel Chanel's son. And my research shows that this couldn't possibly be the case. In any case, she adopted André Palas, and with Boy Capel, educated him in England, brought him up to be a gentleman, found him a senior position in her business, and we will see later how important André Palas was in her life during World War II.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Anne in Fort Worth. Hi, Anne.
Hi. I just have one question, and I'll take the answer off the air. I want to ask the gentleman if, indeed, Igor Stravinsky played a romantic role in Chanel's life.
Thank you for your call.
Mrs. Worth, Stravinsky was a close friend of Chanel's. Chanel befriended him. I have no evidence whatsoever that they had any kind of a love affair. As you may know, there was a film made about Stravinsky and Gabriel Chanel, built about a love affair, which, from my research, never existed. They were close friends. Stravinsky was an extraordinary musician and an incredibly interesting man, but there was no love affair between Chanel and Stravinsky.
She was very social with a lot of the artists and writers and creative people who were hanging around Paris in the 1920s. Did she choose her friends based on what, based on their prominence, or simply were they people that she found interesting?
I believe that it was because she found them interesting. Mm-hmm. She found them interesting, and Chanel was extraordinary in the sense that with the background of her rather complicated personality, we find an incredibly generous person. And indeed, she was very, very close to a lot of the fine painters and writers of the period. And, of course, one of them being later on Picasso, but the most important being a man by the name of Cocteau. And Jacques Cocteau, the poet, the writer, was very, very close to Chanel. And Chanel paid for his period in a clinic in order for him to rid himself of his drug habits. Now, this is the same Cocteau that Chanel criticizes as being a trite homosexual. She goes so far as to say, later on in her life, that the Germans knew that Cocteau couldn't write and ignored his work. In fact, Cocteau was an extraordinary artist, an extraordinary poet, but Chanel was homophobic. There's absolutely no doubt about that.
Is that also a legacy of her time with the nuns?
Certainly it is. I mean, it must come from there. It may also just come from the period. That Chanel is growing up in was the very concept of male involvement with male was intolerable.
I don't want to be flip about this, but it is hard to imagine anyone involved in the fashion industry today who could hold on to homophobic views for very long and be successful.
We have to remember, Chanel dies in 1971.
Right, right.
I believe, or at least I think, that homophobia was probably very prevalent in the 50s and 60s. It isn't till sometime later that we have an enlightenment that suggests that love is love.
How did she meet Winston Churchill, who I guess was instantly taken with her?
Instantly taken with her is a perfect description, Chris. Chanel was probably one of the great seductresses. She was beautiful. She was sexy. She was intelligent. She was spiritual, and she began her English period, what I call her English period, with a love affair between her and the Duke of Westminster. The Duke of Westminster was probably the richest man, was definitely the richest man in England, perhaps one of the richest man in the world. He meets Chanel in Cannes and falls desperately in love with her, and Chanel eventually follows him to England, where she will have a long-lasting love affair with him. It's an affair that lasts for about 6 years, an intense, intimate love affair, and a friendship that lasts to the end of Westminster's life. But it's Westminster who introduces her to the royal family and to Winston Churchill, who is, of course, part of not directly involved in the royal family, but a royal. Churchill was definitely a royal. And he becomes enchanted with Chanel to the point that he writes letters to his wife telling her all about how he met Chanel and how he visited her at her boutique and how they went this place and that place. And for your listeners, you might be interested to know that there are a number of photographs with Churchill and Chanel together. They're either hunting foxes on horseback or salmon fishing. And in the end, of course, it's Winston Churchill who saved Chanel from a dire, dire problem at the end of World War II.
All right, so let's talk about World War II. First of all, why did she shutter her factories during the war?
My opinion is that she shut the factories in 1939 for two basic reasons. One, she was fed up with working. She had had she'd been ill. It was a very bad time for her. She was in competition with all kinds of other people in the fashion business, the most important being Schiaparelli, who began to steal her clientele. And by 1930, during the socialist regime in France, her workers struck her business and closed her down for weeks. This made Chanel absolutely furious. So when 1939 rolled around, she had good reason to, one, get out of the business, as it were, because there was a world war beginning, and two, close the business, which involved 3,000 employees, because she just wasn't getting along with them.
Did they have legitimate grievances against her, do you think?
Oh, they certainly did, yes. Well, Chanel was extraordinarily generous, but it was in a patronizing way.
Mm-hmm.
If she wanted you to work 10 hours or 20 hours because she was bringing out one of her collections, then you did. And if you didn't, you got fired.
Mm-hmm.
We have to remember that in those days, prior to World War II, there were really no labor laws.
So she closed the factory, but she certainly
she closed the factory, but she kept her perfume business open.
Right, right.
And it became her focus now.
And talk about what happened there, because there's an interesting story.
Yes. Well, she closes the factory down. She sees that the Germans, who have now occupied Paris, are fascinated with her perfume. They line up in front of her boutique at Rue Cambon and buy perfume, every bit of perfume they can get. But not only do they buy perfume, when she runs out of perfume, because manufacturing perfume during the war was too difficult, and remember now, Chanel No. 5 is being manufactured in New Jersey by the Wertheimers, who had fled Paris because of their Jewish faith. So she suddenly realizes that perfume had a tremendous potential. But Chanel no longer owned the perfume business. It was 90% owned by the Jewish Wertheimer family. So what did she do? After she had recontacted her German lover, Hans Gunther von Dinklage, the famous Baron Spatz, who was a German agent, German spy, she used her connections with Dinklage and with other people to use the Nazi Aryan laws in order to take over what she had sold to the Wertheimer family in 1924. This is a terrible, terrible business, and it's one of the most disagreeable aspects of Chanel's life, because she was involved with probably some of the worst people in the world. We're talking about the men who were sent to France to appropriate all Jewish property and Jewish businesses. They took the property, they took the business, and they put these families, these men, women, and children, into boxcars and shipped them off to concentration camps. Now, Chanel is living in the Ritz Hotel during this time.
Among
Nazis, and she's dining in the same dining room with them. She's associating with them. And there's no way that Chanel could not have known what was going on during this period when Jewish property and Jewish businesses and families were being treated with with horrible in horrible ways.
As it turned out, though, she was not able to get control of the perfume business.
It turned out that she was enchanted. In fact, she was checked by the Wertheimers. The Wertheimer family was very shrewd. They fully realized that Chanel would try some way to get back the perfume business she'd sold to them in 1924. So they prepared, after they had fled Paris, they gave the business over to an Aryan, Felix Amio, who, amusingly enough, was making warplanes for the German war machine, and who was extremely friendly with Field Marshal Hermann Göring. So when Chanel made her ploy and managed to convince the Gestapo, if you want, in fact it was the Gestapo, that she, as the Aryan, had the rights to her business, Felix Amio, who now had controlled the business, legally had the right to the business, checked her through Hermann Göring. Now, of course, this was at the moment, amiable arrangement with this Amio that the Wertheimers had made, but I must also say that they had some difficulty in getting their business back at the liberation in 1945.
Journalist Hal Vaughn is with us. He's the author of the book Sleeping with the Enemy, Coco Chanel's Secret War, which is available now in a paperback edition. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, call us. The number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, presenting Secrets from the White House Kitchen, lecture, book signing, and hors d'oeuvres, October 16th with Chef John Hanney III. More at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Hal Vaughn, author of the book Sleeping with the Enemy, Coco Chanel's Secret War, which is out now in paperback. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. Email address is think@kera.org. Let's go back to the phones now. We have Jean on the line in Dallas. Hello, Jean.
Hi, Chris. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
One of the questions I had is you mentioned Elsa Schiaparelli earlier, and I'm an undergraduate in fashion, and Elsa Schiaparelli was one of my favorites, and although I know that the book was about Coco Chanel, I'm curious, can you give some background on what the rivalry was other than from an artistic perspective, and can you talk a little bit about how Chanel was able to be so much more successful than Schiaparelli when I consider Schiaparelli's designs to be far more beautiful?
Well, I'm not, I wish I could be helpful to you, but I'm not really somebody who's very experienced about fashion. The only thing that I can tell you is that there's a short period of time when Schiaparelli's fashions intrigued Paris, and intrigued it to the point that she was selling dresses. These are extremely, weird.
Avant-garde?
Weird avant-garde costumes, which had cat's heads as pockets, all kinds of very strange collars and belts and so forth and so on. And for some reason, this intrigued the public, and Schiaparelli was suddenly somebody extremely important and very, very famous, and it just drove Chanel crazy. not only did it drive her crazy, but Schiaparelli began to take clients away from Chanel. And that's more or less all I can tell you about that period, which lasted for about 5 years. And it's the period just preceding World War II, and the socialization of French workers. And it's also during this period that Chanel's business was closed down by her employees.
And she was, during this time, Chanel made her living designing costumes in Hollywood.
Yes, mm-hmm. Indeed. That's a very, very important point, and I'm glad that you brought it up. Chanel was Chanel was invited to Hollywood and given a contract by Sam Goldwyn for $1 million if she would bring her style to his movies. Mm-hmm. And indeed she did. She designed a number of costumes for two or three of Sam Goldwyn's movies, but it all turned very sour because, in fact, Chanel didn't care for life in Hollywood. She thought it was false, and she left Hollywood, collected her $1 million, and in the end, if you look at what she did, there were only very few films that she designed for. And she left with a bad taste in her mouth and certainly a bad taste in Sam Goldwyn's mouth. It cost him $1 million.
Okay, I want to shift topics here because I don't want us to run out of time without talking about the Second World War. First of all, you mentioned her lover, the Baron von Dinklage, and he has been described by some other people as just this German playboy, not particularly political. What did you learn about him?
Well, yes, he's described by most writers as a handsome, trilingual, tennis-playing playboy. And it turns out that he wasn't that at all. My research, which was available, I might add, to other authors, at least a limited amount of it was available, for those people who wrote about Chanel after 1970, the documents that I use were available. They just chose not to use them. But let's get back to Hans Gunther von Dinklage, the famous Baron Spatz. He was the grandson of a German general. He was the son of a German major. He fought in World War I heroically on the Russian front, and immediately thereafter was taken into the German Army Intelligence Service and groomed as a spy. So beginning with 1920, we find that Dinklage and his Jewish wife, I might add, was running a spy business in Toulon, which is the location of the major naval base of the French Navy, the French Mediterranean Fleet. Dinklage was there with his wife, running an operation that was providing the German Navy with photographs, documents, and other espionage material, which was helpful to their war effort. He left there, returned to Germany, and then was assigned to Switzerland, where he spent about 3 years prior to the war, in an espionage operation against the Swiss Army. With the outbreak of World War II, 1940, the invasion of France, Dinklage, who spoke fluent French, fluent English, was assigned to Paris. And Chanel had met Dinklage in England, probably in the mid-1930s, when he was working there as a spy. And he comes to Paris in 1940, and the first person he contacts, or one of the first persons he contacts, is Gabrielle Coco Chanel. Dinklage, the astute espionage agent, the astute intelligence officer, knew that Gabriel Chanel was a key to many, many things in Paris, including ministers, people of high social order, and he also knew that she had a desperate need, and that need was to get her nephew, André Palas, out of a German prisoner of war camp that he had been assigned to after being captured on the Maginot Line in 1939.
And the Maginot Line was this border between France and Germany.
Exactly. This is the border that the Germans cross and invade and take over. André Palas is a private soldier there. He's not even an officer. He's taken and put into a German prisoner of war camp in Germany with thousands of other French soldiers. Now, Dinklage had the power to get André Palas out, but he made a deal with Chanel. He said to Chanel, I can get this done for you, Gabriel, but you're going to have to show to the German authorities that you are partial to Germany. And so he cooked up a project that involved a man by the name of Baron de Vaufriland, who was a Gestapo agent, a French aristocrat who had become a Gestapo agent and a major intelligence officer. And Dinklage brought de Vaufriland together with Chanel and sent them both off to Madrid with the object of having Chanel contact and introduce de Vaufriland into the highest society of Madrid, and with embassies, and particularly the British embassy. And indeed, de Vaufriland, my research shows that de Vaufriland contacted people in these embassies and tried to recruit them to be spies for the Germans.
There was another mission that was given to Coco Chanel that that involved people at the, well, tell the story of the primary mission that she was given.
Yes. So Chanel goes to Madrid. She introduces de Vaufriland. She comes back and she uses her contacts through Dinklage to try to get a hold of her perfume business, and she fails. And now 1942, North African invasion, United States and Britain invade North Africa, take over the French colonies, and people in Paris, collaborators and everybody else, are beginning to wonder, are the Allies going to win the war? And certainly Chanel and Dinklage, by 1943, are very, very worried people.
Mm-hmm.
They're worried because they
picked the wrong side.
The Allies are going to win the war, and they got to do something.
Mm-hmm.
So Dinklage cooks up a mission which brings Chanel to Berlin to meet with the SS General Schellenberger, and suggests that she can contact Chanel, she can contact Winston Churchill in London through the Madrid embassy, where she has very good contacts, and that she can possibly convince Churchill to suspend hostilities so that the Germans can stop the Russians from invading Europe. Remember this, Chanel is terrified of Bolshevism, as are many, many of the elite people in France. And that sounds like a crazy idea, but it isn't, because many, many British were very, very worried about this. And your listeners will certainly remember that following the end of World War II, began the Cold War, and in a certain way, Chanel was right. The Russians, the Stalinists, the Bolshevists, the Communists, were perhaps more dangerous than the Germans.
But she was ultimately not able to meet with Churchill and set this whole thing up.
No, in the end, of course, the whole thing fell apart. It's a very complicated story and very, very difficult to tell in a very short period of time. It's all laid out in my book, but the sum and substance of it is she went to Madrid. She got a hold of the British ambassador. He contacted tried to contact Winston Churchill, who turns out to be desperately ill in Tunisia and later in Morocco. So no contact was possible. And then the British ambassador simply told Chanel and Dinklage, because Dinklage was with her, you better get out of Spain because things are turning bad.
Mm-hmm.
She returns to France. We see that the Germans are defeated. France, Paris is liberated. She's arrested by the Force Française d'Intérieur, which is the communist branch of the resistance movement, de Gaulle's resistance movement, and she's questioned. And through the aegis of Churchill and his ambassador, Duff Cooper, in Paris, she's freed. She leaves for Switzerland, where she will live for the next 9 years with Hans Gunther von Dinklage.
And then after those 9 years were up, she was able to return to Paris, which is surprising in a way. It seems as if she would not be welcomed back.
Fascinating and surprising. And who finances her? Is it believable? But it really is true. She calls up the Wertheimer. She calls up Paul Wertheimer and suggests that she go back into the fashion business. And extraordinarily enough, in 1954, she brings out her 1954 collection, all financed by the Wertheimers. And this family, this man, particularly Paul Wertheimer, who's probably in love with Chanel, financed her comeback, bought out her business, and it is today the Wertheimer family that owns the whole Chanel business, whether it's perfume or jewels or leather belts or bags or fashion items. It's the Wertheimer family who employs Karl Lagerfeld to run the new Chanel.
Did you find yourself, did you like Coco Chanel?
I admired Coco Chanel up to a point.
Mm-hmm.
I admired her. One, I realized the terrible strain she was under as a child. I appreciated her incredible dynamic spirit and her creativity. But I was terribly shocked and terribly turned off by her collaboration with the Nazis, particularly her use of the Nazi,
the Aryan rule,
laws to try to obtain her perfume business back.
Hal Vaughn is a journalist and author of the new book Sleeping with the Enemy, Coco Chanel's Secret War. It's out now in paperback. Hal, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Thank you, and all good wishes to your listeners at Dallas, Texas, KERA.
Thank you. Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bilotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is senior producer. You can learn more about Think and find out about upcoming programs. Plus, you can download the podcast at kera.org/think. Comments, questions, and suggestions can be emailed to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.